Welcome to the Mind Renewed.
They're so worried that they've got to take over down here the direction of where it's going and get a one world system together. Get rid of nationalities and get one government, one religion, so we won't have war. That's the effort of man to bring about his own salvation.
Hello, this is Julian Charles of themindrenewed.com, podcasting to you from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK. And welcome to podcast number 8 of The Mind Renewed, 9/11 and People of Faith. Now, just before we get going with this episode, there are three things that I would like to say, which I think would be helpful to mention. First, throughout this podcast, I shall be using audio clips from various sources, some from interviews I've conducted myself, but often from materials that I found freely available on the internet. Sometimes what I present is only a fragment of the original, so if you have the time to go and listen to the whole thing, then please go and do that, because obviously what I've chosen I think is particularly informative. And you'll find everything I use referenced in the episode notes for the podcast, so you can just go and click on the links to find out more. Secondly, the subject I'm dealing with here, 9/11, is a particularly vast one. I'm not intending to cover either the breadth or the depth of the subject. There is no new research here. All I'm doing is, as it were, drawing attention to the tip of the iceberg and pointing to various issues in order to prompt the asking of questions. For those of you who are already familiar with this subject, this podcast will merely serve as a reminder of some basic points, and I think that's valuable in its own right. But for those of you who haven't yet looked into 9/11, my main hope is that this podcast will prompt you to begin asking your own questions. Thirdly, I know that some people feel that September the 11th, 2001 was, as they say, a long time ago. Shouldn't we be prepared simply to move on and put all this behind us? Well, I have a couple of reactions to that. I actually think 2001 was not that long ago. At my stage in life, 11 years doesn't seem like a vast stretch of time, and surely for those people who were caught up in those events and who lost loved ones, all this must seem like yesterday. So no, I don't think it is all that long ago. But also, 9/11 has current relevance anyway, because the so-called war on terror and domestic surveillance paradigm under which we're living in the Western world is directly traceable back to the events of that day. And that paradigm has been and continues to be so costly in terms of lives lost, liberties threatened, and wealth spent, that I think we need to be as certain as we possibly can be that what we've been told about that day is in fact true. So no, I don't think we can put it behind us, because we have, indeed we must have, questions to ask. That's all I wanted to say. So let's get on with the substance of the podcast itself. Podcast number 8, 9/11 and People of Faith. It's a cliche that most people born in the Western world, say, before the mid-1950s, remember where they were and what they were doing when they heard that President John F. Kennedy had been shot in Dallas on November the 22nd, 1963. It is perhaps an equal cliche of our own times that most people remember where they were and what they were doing when they heard that the Twin Towers in New York City and the Pentagon had been attacked on September the 11th, 2001. I certainly remember what I was doing. I was teaching a high school music class, and I was just preparing to get a group of teenagers to form a class band when one of the lads interrupted me and called out, "Sir, did you hear what's just happened? The Twin Towers in New York have been hit by airplanes. Everybody's talking about it." And at first I wasn't sure if he was teasing me, but as the day unfolded, of course, I discovered that not only had these buildings been hit, but that they'd very soon thereafter fallen straight down, at breathtaking speed, into clouds of dust, taking with them the lives of over 2,500 people. And very soon thereafter, indeed beginning on the day itself, an official narrative began to form, which today has developed into something like this. On the morning of September the 11th, 2001, four passenger aircraft were hijacked by 19 young Arab men acting out the wishes of Osama bin Laden, the extremist Islamic leader of the terrorist group Al-Qaeda, based in Afghanistan. Armed with nothing but small knives, box cutters, and possibly cans of mace or pepper spray, they managed to take control of these planes and fly each, except for one, successfully into its target, without being intercepted at any point by US military defense. First hit was the North Tower of the World Trade Center in Lower Manhattan, followed some 17 minutes later by the South Tower. Within 90 minutes, each of these towers had totally collapsed due to the damage caused by the plane impacts and the fires ignited by the thousands of gallons of jet fuel which fatally weakened the steel structures of the buildings. In addition to the irreparably damaged WTC buildings 3, 4, 5 and 6, one other high-rise steel-framed building, namely WTC building number 7, also suffered a sudden and total collapse, falling for a little over 2 seconds of its descent at actual free-fall speed. This was caused by office fires that followed the impact of the debris from the collapse of the North Tower. At 9:37, a third plane hit the western face of the Pentagon in Arlington County, Virginia, and at 10:03, a fourth plane crashed into a field in southern Pennsylvania, forced down by heroic passengers armed with the knowledge that America was under attack. And that, in a broad brushstroke, is the official narrative. But what if that narrative taken as a whole is untrue? What if significant parts of it are, in reality, based on little or no evidence? Or in some cases, are even contrary to the evidence? Now, it might be argued by some that it's only conspiracy theorists, or at least people who don't really know what they're talking about, who raise questions like these, and so we don't need to take any of it seriously at all. But let me just say a few things about these kinds of responses. First, they're fallacious in themselves, because they fall foul of the well-known, perhaps the best-known, logical fallacy known as argumentum ad hominem, that is, they attack the person bringing the questions rather than bothering to look at the evidence itself. Secondly, the official story itself is a conspiracy theory anyway, because it's a theory about who it was that conspired to bring about those events. So anyone who wants to defend the official narrative cannot say that conspiracy theorizing in itself is irrational. That's exactly what the authorities have done. But also, when you think about it, in simply raising questions, I'm not theorizing or suggesting anyone as a conspirator at all. I'm just raising the possibility that there might be questions to ask about what happened that day. So whichever way you cut it, the accusation, oh, you're just a conspiracy theorist, doesn't really make any sense. Thirdly, is it true that it's pretty much only people who don't know what they're talking about who raise such questions? Well, I find that very hard to believe, given the large number of organisations of professionals that now exist to question 9/11, such as Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, Firefighters for 9/11 Truth, Intelligence Officers for 9/11 Truth, journalists, lawyers, medical professionals, pilots, political leaders, religious leaders, veterans, scholars, all for 9/11 Truth. And in the case of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, more than 1,700 professional architects and engineers have now signed their petition to the House of Representatives and the Senate calling for a proper investigation. So let me just quote from their statement. On behalf of the people of the United States of America, the undersigned Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth and affiliates hereby petition for and demand a truly independent investigation with subpoena power in order to uncover the full truth surrounding the events of 9/11/01. Specifically the collapse of the World Trade Center towers and Building 7. We believe there is sufficient doubt about the official story to justify reopening the 9/11 investigation. The new investigation must include a full inquiry into the possible use of explosives that might have been the actual cause of the destruction of the World Trade Center Twin Towers and Building 7. And then follow over 1,700 signatures. And if that many are actually prepared to commit their names to a cause which, because of its contentious nature, could lead to considerable professional and even personal difficulties, I think we can be pretty confident that many times more than 1,700 are basically in agreement with that petition. One such signatory, who certainly does know what he's talking about, is Kevin Ryan, a chemist and certified quality engineer who prior to 2004 was site manager for Environmental Health Laboratories, a division of Underwriters Laboratories, which was subcontracted to do work for the National Institute of Standards and Technology, or NIST, as part of their World Trade Center investigation. NIST had been given the responsibility at the direction of Congress to determine why and how World Trade Centers 1, 2, and 7 had collapsed. But when in 2004 Kevin Ryan chose publicly to question the very report being drafted by NIST, he wasn't praised for questioning, which after all is what scientists are supposed to do. He was fired. And in 2011, Kevin Ryan gave a very thought-provoking testimony at the Toronto hearings, or the International Hearings on the Events of September the 11th, 2001 at Ryerson University in Toronto. And what he had to say about NIST's reports on the Twin Towers, I think, warrants very close attention.
NIST's stated goals were to explain why and how World Trade Center buildings 1 and 2 collapsed after the initial impact of the aircraft, and why and how World Trade Center Building 7 collapsed. The scientific tests that NIST performed to reach its conclusions included tests to determine gas temperatures, tests to determine steel temperatures, tests to determine the possibility of floor failure, tests to determine the possibility of fireproofing loss. Unfortunately for NIST, none of the tests it performed supported its conclusions, as we will see. NIST therefore based its entire explanation on computer models. A summary of what NIST found was as follows. The aircraft severed columns, loads were redistributed, fireproofing was widely dislodged, high temperatures weakened columns and floors, floors began to sag, sagging floors pulled exterior columns inward, causing them to buckle. Instability spread around the entire building, and then they simply said global collapse ensued. We'll examine each of these steps. The first step in this sequence was that columns were severed. Again, it's agreed that the core columns were massive and over-designed, and the perimeter columns were made of super strong steel. But NIST now admits that 14 to 15% of the columns were severed in the World Trade Center towers. This is compared to original design claims published in the Engineering News Record when the buildings were first announced. They said that one could cut away all the first-story columns on one side of the building and partway from the corners of the perpendicular sides, and the building could still withstand design live loads and a 100-mile-per-hour wind from any direction. What that means, in essence, is that the towers could lose 25% of their columns, and they'd only lost 14 to 15%. The second step in this sequence was that the gravitational load was redistributed among the remaining columns. NIST said that loads on some columns were decreased, and on other columns they were increased up to 25%. Again, original design claims said that live loads on these perimeter columns can be increased more than 2,000% before failure occurs. The third very critical step in this sequence was that fireproofing was, quote, widely dislodged. NIST said the towers would not have collapsed under the combined effects of aircraft impact and the subsequent multi-floor fires if the insulation had not been widely dislodged or had been only minimally dislodged by airliner impact. As said before, the steel structure was covered with a spray-applied fireproofing material. There were requirements for the fireproofing to have a certain bond strength, and those requirements were met. The test that NIST performed to establish the critical fireproofing loss involved a total of 15 rounds from a shotgun at steel plates and bars. But NIST did not explain how a Boeing 757 airliner could be converted into many thousands of shotgun blasts, which would need to be pointed in all directions to shear off the fireproofing. A real serious problem with this is NIST provided to us the energy requirements, and too much energy is required for this. Previous calculations by engineers at MIT had shown that all the kinetic energy available from the aircraft impact was consumed in breaking the columns, crushing the floors, destroying the aircraft. And NIST had tests that showed that 1 megajoule was required for every square meter of surface to shear off the fireproofing via this shotgun blast effect. That's more than 6,000 square meters of column, floor deck, and floor joist surface, according to the NIST report. That would be several times more than the entire kinetic energy available from the aircraft impact. So too much energy required. NIST four-step requires large masses of steel columns and floors to be heated to temperatures that would make the steel soften or lose a great deal of its strength. But the NIST report says that the gas temperatures in the towers were only as high as 1,000 degrees Celsius. It does reference steel temperatures as high as 760 degrees Celsius, but the temperatures given by NIST first of all, do not support their conclusions, and the physical tests that NIST performed resulted in even less agreement. With the physical tests for the steel temperatures, NIST stated goal was to estimate the maximum temperature reached by the available steel. NIST accomplished this by selecting steel samples from an enormous amount of steel and by emphasizing regions of impact and fire damage in the selection process. They did two tests. The first was a paint deformation test, a fairly unusual test that they developed for this purpose, in which they tested painted steel samples over a range of temperatures and then compared the samples they had to that calibration curve. The result was that the samples from the World Trade Center had reached only a temperature of about 250 degrees Celsius. And again, that's much lower than the temperature needed to soften or melt steel, much lower. They did another test of steel microstructure, which showed that none of the steel samples had reached the temperature of 600 degrees Celsius. So again, these tests did not support NIST's hope for conclusions. A point of agreement between NIST and independent scientists is that the fires in any given area were of short duration. NIST claimed that the fires migrated around the core of the building over a period of time because that's where the fire load was. It was not in the core of the building, but in the office areas in the perimeter. For the North Tower, this migration time lasted one full hour, according to NIST, before the fires reached the south wall. So the plane hit the north side of the building. The fires migrated around to the south wall. This left less than 45 minutes in the failure zone. The plane hit the building, fires rose up. NIST says the fires died down. Explosions do that, they consume the oxygen. And then over time, the fires rose up again and began migrating around the core of the building. It took a whole hour for that to happen, leaving 45 minutes of fire time at the south wall. Now, NIST claimed that the south wall then bowed inward from the fires there, but we might ask why the east and west walls, which had seen as much fire time, why they didn't show any bowing. It could be that something else was happening at the south wall. The fifth step in this sequence was that the floors began to sag. My former company, UL, participated in the NIST investigation by conducting tests on models of World Trade Center floor assemblies to examine the floor response to fire. The result was that only very slight sagging occurred in the tests and no collapse. After 45 minutes in a high-temperature furnace, all four test models sagged only about 3 inches in the middle, and the major joist parts did not sag at all. NIST computer model turned this into 42 inches of sagging with the joist bending down severely. To reiterate, UL and NIST built and tested exact replicas of World Trade Center floor assemblies. Here's a photo of one of those floor assemblies after the standard method ASTM E119 was performed. During this test, it was held in a furnace at a temperature over 1,000 degrees Celsius for a period of 2 hours. The midsections of the assembly sagged a few inches, but the frame was not damaged and the floor held its load without failure. The weight loaded was twice as great as what was known to have existed in the World Trade Center. These experiments were performed on four separate floor models, all of which had less fireproofing than was known to have existed in the World Trade Center on September 11th. If the sagging had been severe, as in the computer model, what would have to happen to make the sagging floors create these dramatic pull-in forces, as NIST requires? Sagging floors, for one thing, do not weigh any more than unsagged floors. But to defeat the original design claims, over 30 columns would have to be pulled in, and the floors were known to form this intense staggered grid with the columns, the way it was constructed. And the force required to pull a perimeter column inward within that grid and overcome that was far greater than what a sagging floor assembly could provide. Even within NIST computer models, the sagging and pulling effects that NIST explanation depends on were not seen, not even for the most severe cases examined. Here are several quotes from the NIST report that make that fact clear. Sagging of floors in such a wide range over fire floors was not predicted by full floor model analysis. Locations and magnitudes of pull-in forces were not accurately simulated. Pull-in forces were applied in some locations where the full floor analyses did not predict the development of such behavior. NIST was simply not able to demonstrate this critical pull-in effect. Physical tests were not done, although that would have been decisive. The computer models did not indicate these forces either. And as a result, NIST made some fraudulent changes to the scenario. All the fireproofing was stripped off a large section of the computer-modeled building, and exaggerated temperatures were applied for twice as long as NIST had said occurred in the failure zones. That is, they applied exaggerated temperatures for 90 minutes instead of 45 minutes. But even then, the pull-in forces were not created in the computer. So NIST did something completely paradoxical. It disconnected the floors before applying an imaginary pull-in force. So NIST, in their computer model, the floors were heated up, they sagged, they still wouldn't pull in, so they disconnected the floors, and then they applied a pull-in force. You see, this is the opposite of science. This is not anywhere near science. No physical test done, the computer models did not give them the answer they want, so they do something completely fraudulent, which is exactly what they did. The final step of NIST's sequence for the towers was that instability caused by the perimeter columns pulling inward spread around the entire perimeter of the building. This would be necessary to explain the perfectly uniform fall. Again, no tests of any kind were performed to confirm this instability spread. And for several reasons, it does not appear to be realistic. The buildings fell at near free fall acceleration, so the instability would have to fit within that time frame. If we give it only half a second of the time, then this instability spread is moving at nearly twice the speed of sound. That's not realistic. It's not shown in the photos. But again, building professionals, they're aware. They've been aware for years that a steel structure does not collapse suddenly when attacked by fire. There are unmistakable warning signs like large deformations. So let's review some of the key tests that NIST did perform and see how the results were used. They asked what were the steel temperatures, found that they were 250 degrees Celsius, and then plugged 760 degrees Celsius into the computer. They asked if the fireproofing was widely dislodged, and their unrealistic test really showed that it could not have happened for that area of the building, and the fireproofing was entirely removed from the computer sections. They asked how much the floors could have sagged, and after two hours in the furnace, they sagged 3 inches, and in the computer, they sagged 42 inches after less than an hour. They asked if pull-in forces could be created. They're not produced in the computer. They did no physical tests, and they simply disconnected the floors and applied imaginary forces. And again, just to be clear, the task was why and how these buildings collapsed, and they stopped at the collapse initiation and not explain the dynamics of the building's collapse at all. So some of the evidence that they ignored when they ignored the actual collapse dynamics include the resistance of the structure below. If each floor caused only a half a second of hesitation, as you would think, an extra 40 seconds would be needed. They have these squibs coming out. They ignore that when they don't explain the collapse dynamics. They ignore molten metal, which you'll hear more about in the next few days. They ignore intergranular melting and sulfidation found on the steel by the earlier investigation done by the Federal Emergency Management Administration, or FEMA. In my opinion, this is my opinion, what objective scientists would have found, relatively few columns were lost on impact. Remaining columns had considerable extra capacity. Fireproofing could not have been widely dislodged. Steel could not have softened or weakened at the temperatures found. Even at higher temperatures and longer periods, tests showed minimal sagging of the floors. Forces were simply not produced to pull the columns inward, and instability spread would take much more time and would not result in uniform free fall. So finally, for the towers, the NIST report is false because NIST did not explain why and how the buildings collapsed, and the investigation was deceptive and unscientific. NIST reported findings that were in direct contradiction to the physical testing performed. This is what I was fired from my job for stating. NIST omitted or distorted many important facts.
Now, I'm going to return to Kevin Ryan's testimony a little later, because he goes on to talk about NIST's final report on Building Number 7. But let me just say that if you want to hear the whole of his testimony, including the Q&A at the end, And if you want to hear the several other expert witness testimonies given during those hearings, which I can tell you are equally fascinating and well worth the time spent on them, then just go over to the episode notes and you will find links to free low-quality recordings and a link to Press for Truth, pressfortruth.ca, where you can purchase a high-quality DVD of the full proceedings. So if you have the cash to do that in this increasingly cash-strapped world that we're living in at the moment, then that's what I recommend you do, because it does help to support their work. Now, I can't vouch for the scientific validity of Kevin Ryan's work. I'm not an engineer. I'm not a scientist. But in a way, that's not the point. The point is that here we have an example of a qualified and experienced scientist and engineer, one among very many, as I've already said, who remains not only dissatisfied, but severely critical of NIST's work. And of course, it is this work that provides the main technical support for the official narrative, according to which these buildings collapsed due to aircraft impacts and fire. So if more than 1,700 people like that are prepared to declare their dissatisfaction, I think that should be enough in itself at least to make us pause and ask the question, have we really been told the truth about what happened that day? But I guess it might be said that even if it's true that NIST's reports are flawed, we do nevertheless still have the 2004 9/11 Commission report. After all, the Commission was mandated to, and I quote, investigate facts and circumstances relating to the terrorist attacks of September the 11th, 2001, including those relating to intelligence agencies, law agencies, diplomacy, immigration issues and border control, the flow of assets to terrorist organizations, commercial aviation, the role of congressional oversight and resource allocation, reviewed more than 2.5 million pages of documents, interviewed more than 1,200 individuals in 10 countries. We have sought to be independent, impartial, thorough, and non-partisan. A very comprehensive and thorough job, so it sounds. Pity then that so many of the 10 commissioners themselves and other senior people involved with the work of the commission expressed such dissatisfaction with how the investigation was conducted. In 2006, Thomas Keane and Lee Hamilton, respectively the chair and vice chair of the commission, published their book Without Precedent, The Inside Story of the 9/11 Commission, in which, while of course maintaining that the commission had still succeeded against all the odds, they had nevertheless been, so they said, set up to fail.
Lee and I write in our book that we think the commission in many ways was set up to fail, because we had not enough money, we didn't have enough time, we had been appointed by the most partisan people in Washington, the leaders of the House and Senate.
Even Lee Hamilton, the co-chair of the 9/11 Commission itself, admits to us that the process he headed up was seriously flawed.
So there are all kinds of reasons we thought we were set up to fail. We got started late. We had a very short time frame. Indeed, we had to get it extended. We did not have enough money. They were afraid we were going to hang somebody.
And in 2008, writing in the New York Times in an op-ed entitled Stonewalled by the CIA, they added, "The Commission's mandate was sweeping, and it explicitly included the intelligence agencies. But the recent revelations that the CIA destroyed videotaped interrogations of Qaeda operatives leads us to conclude that the agency failed to respond to our lawful requests for information about the 9/11 plot. Those who knew about those videotapes, and did not tell us about them, obstructed our investigation." In 2006, CNN.com reported that Commissioner Timothy Roemer was very unhappy with the false statements coming from Pentagon officials about the timeline of events on 9/11. Quote, "We were extremely frustrated with the false statements we were getting. We were not sure of the intent, whether it was to deceive the commission or merely part of the fumbling bureaucracy." In 2008, according to George Washington's blog, 9/11 Commissioner John Layman said on NBC Nightly News, quote, "We purposely put together a staff that had, in a way, conflicts of interest. All of the staff had, to a certain extent, some conflict of interest." In 2009, We Are Change LA published footage of Bob Kerry expressing his dissatisfaction with the commission.
The 9/11 Commission was, I'll tell you what it was, you've got 535 people in Congress with full subpoena powers to investigate anything that you wanted to do. We were a temporary body. We had subpoena powers for less than a year, insufficient resources, the statute ended, we were out of business. We were all part-time people. We had limited time to be able to do the work. Most of us were not professionals. I probably had the most experience with the structures of the intelligence agencies because I'd been on the committee for 8 years. So to expect the 9/11 Commission is going to answer every damn question that you've got under the sun is an unreasonable expectation. You've got an intelligence committee in the House, an intelligence committee in the Senate, both Armed Services Committee on both sides. And, you know, I've had the joyous opportunity to have this conversation many times since we shut down and went out of business. You've got a Congress that has the power, in my view, to investigate and examine any question that you've got. And I do think a permanent commission is not just the answer to this, although it may not be the answer to your lines of questions, but I do think it's essential if you're going to operate in an environment where, whatever the reason, you put under wraps in a top secret way facts and things that are going on and American people don't have access to them, because it makes it difficult, I think, to maintain the confidence people need that the government's telling the most part the truth.
In 2006, in a Washington Post article entitled 9/11 Panel Suspected Deception by Pentagon, John Farmer, who was senior counsel to the 9/11 Commission, was reported as saying with respect to the FAA and NORAD audio tapes that were later obtained by subpoena, quote, "I was shocked at how different the truth was from the way it was described. The tapes told a radically different story from what had been told to us and the public for 2 years. This is not spin. This is not true." And perhaps most dramatic, Max Cleland, the former state senator for Georgia, who had originally been appointed as one of the 10 commissioners, in 2003 resigned because he felt the work of the commission was hopelessly compromised by a deal between the White House and the commission.
A deal announced yesterday between the White House and the commission investigating the September 11th attacks is proving to be rather controversial. Under the agreement, only certain members of the commission will be allowed to review classified documents from the White House, and their notes will be subject to administration review. Today, some relatives of people who were killed in the attacks criticized the agreement, and our next guest, who's a member of the commission, claimed the deal is disgusting. Former Georgia Senator Max Cleland, a Democrat, joins me here in Washington. Senator, thanks so much for joining us.
Yes,
some of the members of the commission say this is a fair compromise. First of all, what's the deal? What's the notion of this agreement?
Well, you've used the word deal three times. I don't think the 9/11 Commission ought to be making deals with our own government under the responsibility we have from the Congress and our responsibility to the American people. To get all the facts about all the commissioners, look at those facts. Now, we've had to subpoena the FAA for those documents. We've had to subpoena NORAD for those documents. I'm in favor of subpoenaing the White House for the documents we need so that all the commissioners can get to see all the documents that we need. That's the only way we can face the American people and the families and say we have done a thorough investigation independently of the White House and the entire executive branch.
Some of the commissioners, including Richard Benveniste, who's a Democrat, a former Watergate prosecutor, says this is a fair arrangement. Four members of the commission will be able to have access to these classified documents. They'll be able to review them and eventually make some of the information available to the other members of the commission, depending on what the White House says.
Secondhand. I mean, I'm a member of the commission. The president has said only a minority of the commission can see a minority of the documents, and then they have to clear what they're going to say to the rest of the commission with the White House.
If you're one of those four that gets to see these documents, would that change your opinion?
No, because all the members of the commission are legitimate members of the commission. We have the top security clearances. We're an independent commission. For an independent operational look at why 9/11 happened, what happened there, what the president and the government knew, and when they knew it.
What's their argument, the White House? Why won't they let you see this? What do they say?
They don't want any more eyeballs to see their documents than they can possibly get away with. It's a scam. It's absolutely disgusting. This is an independent commission looking at the most serious attack on this homeland since the British invaded this country in the War of 1812. This is important. We cannot do our responsibilities if we don't have all of us access to all the documents we need, including what's in the White House. Now, We've already had to go to the wall for documents with the FAA and NORAD in a subpoena.
So why do you think
we ought to subpoena the White House documents and get on with this investigation.
Why do you think your chairman, the former Republican governor of New Jersey, Tom Kaine, other members of the commission, apparently a majority, have accepted this arrangement with the White House?
It's a deal. We shouldn't be in the business of making deals. We should not be in the business of taking some commissioners and say they get to see some information cleared by the White House and other commissioners don't. And then they got to clear it with the White House to come back to tell those commissioners what that's all about. I think this is ludicrous.
So what if anything can you do about it?
Well, first of all, I'm very much for issuing a subpoena to those in the White House that would obstruct this investigation. And that's what we have here, an obstruction of a full investigation on the most serious attack on the homeland in the last 150 years.
And when we add to all that the fact that the commission's research was directed by a certain Dr. Philip Zelikow, the claim that the commission was independent is really hard to swallow. As David Ray Griffin explains in his book Debunking 9/11 Debunking, quote, Zelikow had worked with Condoleezza Rice on the National Security Council in the administration of the first President Bush. When the Republicans were out of office during the Clinton administration, Zelikow and Rice wrote a book together. Then, when Rice was named National Security Advisor for the second President Bush, she had Zelikow help make the transition to the new National Security Council. And as to the influence of Philip Zelikow over the commission, Griffin continues, the commission's staff, composed of some 75 members, was organized by Zelikow into various teams, to each of which he gave a topic to investigate. Zelikow had enormous power, therefore, to determine what the commission would investigate, and therefore what it would not investigate. Zelikow was, moreover, evidently not reluctant to exercise his power to shape the commission's results. As one disgruntled member of staff reportedly said at the time, Zelikow is calling the shots. He's skewing the investigation and running it his own way. Now, given all that, I find it impossible to believe that the commission succeeded in being independent, impartial, and thorough. They may have, as they said, sought to be, but that they achieved it seems to me at least pretty unlikely. So if these two pillars of support for the official narrative, NIST's report on WTC 1 and 2 and the 9/11 Commission, look shaky, well, perhaps a more secure foundation is to be found with NIST's research into the collapse of Building No. 7. One very real problem for the official story, according to which Building No. 7 collapsed primarily due to office fires, is the fact, admitted by virtually everyone who looks at the video footage, that it looks exactly like a controlled demolition. And if you've not seen that footage, I cannot stress strongly enough how important it is to take a look at that, because it is truly startling. It's easy enough to find on YouTube, but you can go to Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, where it's easily accessible. There's even a link to one of the videos on my website in the video resources section. And of course, if this was a controlled demolition, that would really open a can of worms, because such demolitions require weeks, if not months, of careful installation of cutting charges. Given some of the tenants of Building No. 7, which included the Office of Emergency Management, the US Secret Service, the Department of Defense, and the CIA, I don't think any fair-minded person could think that Al-Qaeda could have installed those charges. That it certainly looks like a controlled demolition was even admitted by the BBC in their Conspiracy Theory series programme, 9/11. During an interview with David Coburn of Popular Mechanics, a magazine that has consistently defended the official position, the BBC interviewer bluntly stated, "But it looks exactly like a controlled demolition." Well, here is the conversation, including Mr. Coburn's response.
We're standing here north of Ground Zero in the original footprint of World Trade Center 7, which is this dark building, and we're on the eastern corner here. The south tower stood directly behind us in front of where that black building is now, and the north tower was a little bit around the corner there. Here on this video, you can actually see what happens. This is looking directly south at where we're standing now. We're down here.
But it does look exactly like a controlled demolition.
I understand why people might think that, and I see what they're saying, but when you learn the facts about the way that the building was built and about the way that it supported itself and the damage that was done from the collapsing towers that preceded it, the idea that it was a demolition just holds no water.
Now, whereas Mr. Coburn himself seemed very reluctant to go so far as to admit that it does in fact look like a controlled demolition, the BBC clearly recognised that it does look like a controlled demolition. But by including Mr. Coburn's reply in the way that they did, the BBC was clearly suggesting that the admittedly reasonable impression of controlled demolition can be fully undercut by greater knowledge. As a philosopher might put it on behalf of the BBC, we are perfectly rational to believe something that is strongly presented to our senses and understanding, so long as we don't have a defeater for that belief, that is, so long as there aren't persuasive reasons to think otherwise. So I shall agree with the BBC. I am rational to believe that it is indeed a controlled demolition, unless and until I have a defeater for that belief. And what better source for that defeater could there be now than NIST's 2008 final report on Building Number 7? If that holds water, then I shall concede that my senses deceive me. But of course, I'm a non-expert. So to find out if NIST's work is at least reasonably watertight, let's turn once more to Kevin Ryan.
Now I would like to examine the NIST report for World Trade Center Building 7, the third building that collapsed on 9/11. Although we should look closely at the final NIST explanation, and we will, it's also informative to recognize that the previous government investigation reported by FEMA provided a best hypothesis that all agreed had only a low probability of occurrence. This building was 47 stories tall, was not hit by a plane, and yet at 5:20 in the afternoon on 9/11, it fell vertically and symmetrically in 6.5 seconds. After 7 years of waiting, NIST finally put out its official report on Building 7 in 2008. No one could have predicted the sequence of events that NIST says led to this building falling. It says that normal office fires caused fully fireproof steel beams to fail in one area of the building, and that's what led to this entire structure falling as it did into a neat rubble pile. To reiterate, the official story of the collapse of Building 7 is that a typical office fire caused this 47-story building to fall in a matter of seconds. If we were to accept this NIST World Trade Center Building 7 report, we would have to conclude that no tall buildings are safe from the possibility of total unexpected collapse due to office fires. All parties have agreed that the start of the collapse of World Trade Center Building 7 was very problematic. FEMA said the performance of Building 7 is of significant interest because it appears the collapse was due primarily to fire rather than any significant damage from the collapsing towers. And NIST said this was the first known instance of the total collapse of a tall building primarily due to fires. They appear to be ignoring the towers. The low probability hypothesis that FEMA described was that diesel fuel fires driven by diesel fuel tanks located within the building created intense fires that caused the collapse. And for years, NIST promoted that diesel fuel fires hypothesis as well, but NIST abandoned that hypothesis in its final report. NIST said diesel fuel fires did not play a role in the collapse of Building 7. NIST also suggested for years that the damage caused by falling debris from the North Tower was a root cause of the collapse of Building 7. Ultimately, NIST gave up on that hypothesis as well, saying other than initiating the fires in Building 7, the damage from the debris from North Tower 1 had little effect on initiating the collapse of Building 7. And contrary to some media reports, the building design was not an issue either. We'll take a look at NIST's final theory now, but we should remember that it's entirely computer-based. NIST did no physical testing at all to support its Building 7 report. Here are the basics of the NIST explanation for what happened to Building 7. The fact is they're saying that fire-induced thermal expansion of the floor system surrounding Column 79 led to the collapse of Floor 13, which triggered a cascade of floor failures. In this case, the floor beams on the east side of the building expanded enough so that they pushed a girder spanning between two columns, and this caused the girder to walk off its seat. That caused the whole building essentially to collapse. NIST says fires on the northeast corner of floor 12 heated the ceiling that included the floor beams for floor 13, causing thermal expansion of the beams. That is, the beams, the floor beams, heated and they expanded and they pushed this girder off its seat. NIST said that column 79 then buckled due to loss of support from the girder and the whole building collapsed in a matter of seconds. An important point here, when we're talking about floors and the beams below them, is something called shear studs. The NIST interim report from 2004 said that most of the beams and the girders were made composite, or one piece, the floor and the beam, one piece with these studs. In a deceptive turnabout, in their final report, they said that no shear studs were installed on any of the girders. Unfortunately for NIST, it's not just its own 2004 interim report that contradicted this vital aspect of the final theory. The presence of shear studs on all the girders was also described by John Salvarinas, the project manager for Building 7, from the company that supplied the steel components. This diagram from an academic paper that Salvarinas wrote in 1986 showed that there were 30 shear studs on that critical girder. NIST claims that thermal expansion caused the breakage of over 100 bolts, high-strength bolts. The mechanism that NIST claims caused all this damage is called differential thermal expansion. This is when the expansion of the beam below is much greater than the expansion of the concrete's floor slab above it when they're both heated in a fire. Thermal expansion is not a new phenomenon, as NIST suggests, but has been a consideration throughout the history of structural design. You can see that point made here by two building professionals from Australia who wrote a response to NIST on its Building 7 report. These building professionals reported that they had actually done physical tests to see what thermal expansion would do to floor assemblies. These were just the kinds of tests that NIST should have done. Because they had actually done the test, the Australians were able to state that the shear studs would not fail, because in a building fire, the floor slab would be heated as well, and the entire composite assembly would expand together. The concrete coefficient of expansion is very similar to that of steel. They would expand together at the same rate. So NIST's final theory is at odds with actual experimental evidence from the testing of real floor assemblies. Another thing we need to understand is just how far that girder would have to be pushed for it to walk off its seat, as NIST suggests. NIST reported that the girder seat at column 79 was 11 inches wide, and therefore the girder had to be pushed at least 5.5 inches, or half that distance, to walk off its seat. To repeat, NIST's initial failure mechanism for Building 7 was that the critical girder was pushed 5.5 inches by the floor beams. The 5.5 inches was needed in order for the vertical web of the girder, and therefore the center of mass of the girder, to move off the seat, theoretically. Because thermal expansion is a function of temperature, we need to know what temperature NIST says the beams reach so that we can estimate how much they expanded. This was a tricky question for NIST, because at temperatures as high as 600 degrees Celsius, the steel will lose some strength and stiffness, and therefore not be able to extend into the girder. At the same time, if the temperature's not high enough, there wouldn't be enough expansion of the beams. What NIST settled on was just in the area of the northeast corner of floor 12, the beam temperatures reached 400 degrees Celsius. NIST computer models had all the steel heating to extreme temperatures and all the bolts and other connections breaking within a matter of about 2 seconds. This is an example of how NIST computer modeling was not realistic. Once the temperature distribution for its theory was settled, NIST found a way to suggest that the differential thermal expansion could be possible, at least in the computer. They simply didn't heat the floor slab above. And this is what most scientists might call fraud. If you don't heat the floor slab, of course the beam's going to extend in differential expansion. But NIST theories has more problems than that. Given NIST temperature scenario, the amount of expansion by the beams would not satisfy the amount of expansion that NIST said was required, or 5.5 inches. NIST provided an example of the equation that NIST scientists use to calculate thermal expansion. When we put the correct values in the equation, we see that the maximum expansion would be only 3.3 inches. And as we already know from NIST, 3.3 inches would not be enough to cause the girder to walk off its seat. We know that the girder would have had to be pushed at least 5.5 inches for NIST's very improbable scenario to even begin. Another thing NIST said was that there were 7-hour fires in Building 7, which gave the impression that the fires were very long and very hot. But early photographs did not show fires on floors 11 through 13, where NIST says the first failures occurred, until after 2 p.m. and the building fell less than 3.5 hours later. So there could not have been 7-hour fires in those areas. Underwriters Laboratories provided the fire resistance information for Building 7 as well. There were requirements for fire resistance of the columns and floor steel in Building 7, just as there is for any skyscraper. The requirements were that these steel components had to withstand 2 to 3 hours of intense fire in standard tests. One big contradiction that NIST avoided is that its investigators knew that the fire load in the building would only support about 20 minutes of fire in a given area. When the NIST report talks about several hours of fire, it's deceptively talking about the time that a fire lasts anywhere on a floor, not in one specific location. Underneath a floor beam, for example, the fire time is only about 20 minutes, as this exchange from a NIST advisory committee meeting indicates. The NIST advisor, Charles Thornton, asked, "Fire moved every 20 minutes. Essentially, it started and stopped every 20 minutes. So if you do not have fuel in Building 7, how could fires burn for as long as they had and taken out this major structure that had good fireproofing?" Good question. And the lead investigator, Shyam Sunder, essentially admitted, yes, the fire moved from location to location every 20 minutes. And while the combustibles were being consumed, the fire front would continue moving to adjacent combustibles. So 20 minutes of fire in any given location. Another problem that NIST did not explain is that the fires on floor 12 were completely burned out at least 30 minutes before the building fell. And it's well known that steel cools quickly after a source of heat is removed. We should be able to verify how long the fires lasted in a given location because there are photographs available from various times during the day, but it turns out that NIST did not use the photographs to verify its computer simulations. As you can see from this comparison of a photo in NIST report taken at about 4 p.m., and the NIST simulation of fires on floor 12 at the same time, there is no correlation between NIST simulation and what really happened. At approximately 4 o'clock, NIST computer simulation shows raging fires across the north side windows of floor 12. The photo from the same time shows no fires in that area at all. NIST admits that its models did not use the observed fire activity from the photos and videos as a model input. Again, this is not science, and this is another example of why the NIST report is false. There are significant problems with NIST's description of the collapse dynamics as well. One problem is that the computer model output does not match what we see in videos. As you can see here, NIST computer model suggests the building crumpled from the sides before falling. Another problem is that NIST has admitted that Building 7 fell at free fall acceleration for a period of time, and that simply cannot occur without the structure below being removed by some unexplained forces. But to sum up, why the NIST World Trade Center 7 report is unscientific and false is that no physical tests were done to confirm the NIST explanation. The fire hypothesis is contradicted by known fire resistance plans. The fire in the building lasted only 20 minutes in a given area, while the steel components were rated for hours of fire resistance. NIST's final theory was based entirely on computer simulations that are not based on evidence. NIST fire modeling contradicts the photographic evidence. The fires in the critical areas were out long before collapse. NIST did not heat the floor slabs in its model of differential thermal expansion. NIST ignored known facts about shear studs on the critical girder. The maximum thermal expansion possible could not have caused the girder to walk off its seat. And this computer result does not accurately model the collapse. Regardless of the fact that the NIST World Trade Center 7 report is false in many ways, we'd like to see how NIST reached its conclusions. But we're not allowed to see those things. Structural engineer Ron Brookman, a colleague of mine, made a FOIA request to NIST in 2009 asking for the calculations and analysis behind the claim of girder walk-off failures. NIST responded that the release of that information might jeopardize public safety. That's the response. So finally, I would just say again that NIST produced World Trade Center reports that are false, They did not explain why and how the buildings collapsed, and the investigations were deceptive and unscientific. NIST reported findings that were in direct contradiction to the physical testing performed. NIST omitted or distorted many important facts. They will not share the results with the public, and therefore, an important point here, these results cannot be independently verified as required in science. And NIST explanations have not been taken seriously by the building construction community. So thank you.
Now, if it were claimed that NIST's work provides a defeater for the belief in controlled demolition, then Kevin Ryan's assessment must surely, in turn, provide a defeater for that defeater. Thus, not only are we still rational to trust our initial reasonable intuition that this was a controlled demolition, because it seems no satisfactory reason has been given to think otherwise, but our belief has actually been strengthened, because what NIST has offered, presumably, is the best alternative to controlled demolition. And if that has failed, then surely our reasonable intuition must be all the more secure. But beyond the visual characteristics of the collapse itself, is there any further evidence in favour of controlled demolition? And the answer to that is yes. And I was very privileged to have the opportunity to speak to Dr. Niels Harrit, a chemistry professor at the University of Copenhagen, who in 2009 published a peer-reviewed article entitled Active Thermitic Material Discovered in Dust from the 9/11 World Trade Center Catastrophe. And I was able to ask him about this active thermitic material, or the small red-grey chips as they're more commonly known, and what bearing their presence in the WTC dust had on the hypothesis of controlled demolition.
Stephen E. Jones, who I just mentioned, 2006, he was the one, and he should be given all the credit for having initiated this research. He started to look into the dust of 9/11. Up until that time, there had been already two reports on the pulverization of the skyscrapers, one from a private company called the R.J. Lee Group in 2003 and 4, it was published, and another publication from the United States Geological Survey, which came out in 2005. And just from reading these reports and actually requesting some supplementary material from a Freedom of Information Act request, there were some data which they wouldn't release, but they had to, the United States, the Geological Institute. So, but when he got them, he wrote a paper, because in the dust, there are many, many findings, each of them alone implying that there were very high temperatures occurring during the collapses of the World Trade Center skyscrapers. I could, of course, go into details of that, but let me just mention a finding of some tiny iron spheres. These are completely round iron particles in a huge quantity, actually, 5.87%. This is enormous compared to ordinary building dust. And the occurrence of these iron particles in themselves alone, and this is not our finding, this was known already at that time, imply that thermite was used during the demolition of the World Trade Center skyscrapers. And we could stop here, actually, because this is enough. But when I'm talking about thermite, I have to explain a little bit what this means. The word goes more than 100 years back, actually, to a German chemist called Hans Goldschmidt, who in 1893 discovered that a mixture of pulverized aluminum powder, and iron oxide, which you may call rust, pulverized rust, the mixture of these two solid materials, like gunpowder, if you can make them react, the reaction is very violent in the sense that enormous heat is produced and the product is elemental iron. So what it's doing, the aluminum is reducing the rust to elemental iron, but the iron comes out at a temperature of 2,500 degrees centigrade, which is roughly 100 degrees higher than the melting point of iron and steel. So the thermite reaction is very useful. It can be used for welding, and was patented already in 1898 for that purpose. But because the iron produced in the process has this enormous temperature, it can also be used for the destruction of other iron items or steel items. And now I'm talking about armor. So the thermite reaction has been used for military purposes for many, many years after the First World War I in torpedoes and grenades. But the classical old-time kind of thermite is not an explosive. It is an incendiary. It destroys other things by means of heat, while an explosive, as you may know, destroys things by means of pressure. An explosive mechanically blows things apart, but an incendiary destroys things by means of heat. So a torpedo, which has a thermite charge, is actually melting its way through the warship. There's a lot of energy in the thermite reaction. And in recent years, and this means from the early 90s, this has been subject of military research to use the energy of the thermite reaction and into an explosive action. That is, that you add chemicals to the reaction, forming this pressure wave, which makes the material an explosive. And at the same time, maybe you recall, we saw the advent of nanotechnology, which is a field of technology in between molecular sciences like chemistry and what we call bulk materials, which is the realm of physics. Nanotechnology is a border discipline between our physical world and the world of chemistry, which is molecules. It is, just makes all the particles much smaller. So what you have particles almost the size of molecules. They're bigger than molecules, but they are so small that in this case, when we are in the thermite reaction, it's a solid state reaction. That is, there's two powders reacting with each other. But if you make the particles very, very small, the reaction is much faster and much more violent. So if we talk about nanothermite, where the particles are approaching molecular dimensions, the reaction is roughly 100 times faster than the classical thermite reaction.
But your paper says that you have found material that you reckon to be nanothermite.
Yeah, it reacts. That's the most pertinent finding of ours. It is that some of the chips we found are still reactive. Because when you apply an explosive or an incendiary, there's always something left. So this, again, we must credit Professor Stephen Jones. He started to look for unreacted material. Maybe there's something left. That was his thought. We knew thermite has been used for other reasons, which I maybe get a chance to mention. And so he started simply to see if there should be something left, and found these red gray chips. And most pertinent, when you heat them up, they react and form elementary iron. And that is the single, actually, observation which makes it thermitic material.
And this is consistent with the microspheres of iron which was found in the dust?
Strangely enough, yes. But we have strictly speaking, we must say that this is just a strange coincidence, but mm-hmm. it's consistent. Mm-hmm. The model is consistent, and consistency is an important requirement for any scientific statement, yes.
Now, we mustn't misinterpret Dr. Harrit when he says it's a coincidence. He doesn't mean that in the colloquial sense of, oh, it's just a coincidence so we can forget all about it. He means it in the technical sense of consilience. That is, on its own, this finding is not sufficient to prove the hypothesis of controlled demolition, but it is nevertheless consilient, or consistent with that hypothesis, and so this finding certainly does provide empirical evidence in its favour. Of course, what would be really nice would be if we could see this nanothermite in action, but perhaps that is asking a bit too much. Not according to David Chandler, the physics teacher who has conducted extensive research on video footage of the collapses. In two very important videos called South Tower Smoking Guns and South Tower Smoking Guns Follow-Up, he analyses the collapse of the South Tower and identifies what he believes to be the action of nanothermite on debris being ejected from that building. Now, obviously, in a podcast, I can't show the video, so I urge you to go and take a look for yourself. Again, there's a link in the episode notes. Please do look at this because it is really intriguing. But of course, what I can do is play the audio. So here is David Chandler narrating what he suspects is the action of the very nanothermite that Dr. Harrit and his team have discovered in the World Trade Center dust.
In my earlier video entitled South Tower Smoking Guns, I pointed out a projectile near the end of the clip that moves to the right, then suddenly turns through a sharp angle and moves downward, at least from the perspective of the camera, all the while producing a trail of white smoke. For this object to radically change directions like this, it had to experience a sudden impulse. We know there was a large amount of unreacted nanothermite in the World Trade Center dust. That was confirmed in a paper published in the Chemical Physics Journal in April 2009. Thermite reactions produce aluminum oxide, which is visible as white smoke, and nanothermite is explosive. Nanothermite is stable when wet and can be literally painted onto steel beams. Nanothermite painted onto this chunk of material would explain the explosion producing the sudden change of direction, and it would also explain the white smoke trail. When we zoom in, we can see that the path zigzags, indicating multiple small explosions. Once I found this projectile, I looked for it in other videos. I found it in several videos from different angles, but when shown against the backdrop of the white debris cloud, it is very hard to see. This is another video from a very similar perspective to the first. In this shot, the trail can be seen to persist all the way down to the bottom of the collapse. We can learn several things from the behavior of this projectile. First, it is clear that this chunk carries explosive material with sufficient power to drastically change its momentum in a short outburst. Secondly, it is clear that the smoke we see is not general smoke from the fires, entrained in the wake of a moving object. Since the smoke trail follows the object in all of its twists and turns, it is clear that the smoke is being emitted from the object itself. The most obvious interpretation, of course, is we are seeing the results of nanothermite burning and undergoing explosive outbursts. Once we see this clear example of an object trailing smoke generated on its surface, we can reinterpret what we are seeing elsewhere. There are lots of chunks of falling debris trailing smoke clouds. In many cases, we can see long beams with smoke being emitted from the entire length of the beam. We no longer need to assume that this is smoke following in their wake. When we see white smoke that looks as though it's coming from the girders, it is reasonable to assume that we are in fact seeing smoke coming from material painted onto the girders themselves. When we see chunks that race ahead of the rest of the falling debris, as we see near the bottom of this view, we can reasonably interpret this as caused by explosive impulses that increase the speed of these objects, just as they change the direction of the one we've been studying. It is time to take off the blinders. We have not only chemically detected nanothermite in the World Trade Center dust, we are literally seeing nanothermite in action. Once our eyes are open, we can see it wherever we look.
But I guess the skeptical listener, whom I welcome, might say, well, even if thermite or nanothermite is there, surely NIST must have taken that into consideration and had a good look at Stephen E. Jones's initial work, which identified the chemical indicators of thermite in the WTC wreckage, and decided to reject that. Well, let's hear what Dr. Shyam Sunder, who led the NIST investigations, had to say about that when he was interviewed by Alan Rees of No Lies Radio on the very day NIST released its final report on Building Number 7.
Last year, physicist Stephen Jones and two other physicists and a geologist analyzed the slag at the end of the beams, and they found iron, aluminum, sulfur, manganese, and fluorine, the chemical evidence for thermate, a high-tech incendiary cutting charge used by the military. The byproduct of thermite is molten iron. Now, did you, in your investigation, did you interview these physicists or examine their evidence and findings?
No, we did not.
Why not?
And for a very simple reason. We looked at all of the alternative hypotheses that were being presented. We looked at the, so we considered all of the possible hypotheses, and then we made a technical judgment in terms of what would actually be a credible hypothesis. And among the credible hypotheses we identified were the diesel fuel that was stored to power up the emergency generators in the building, the transfer elements, transfer trusses, girders, and overhangs that were in the building because the office building was built on top of an electric substation. And third, we wanted to look at hypothetical blast events because there was some suggestion, though we had not seen any evidence of it, that the manner in which Tower 7, Building 7, seemed to collapse was similar in some features to a controlled demolition. Beyond that, we looked at clearly the information about alternative theories beyond these three or four that I just mentioned and did not feel that any of them were credible enough in our technical judgment.
Okay, now, National Fire Protection Association, NFPA 921 Guide for Fire and Explosion Investigations, dictates in a fire investigation that certain residues be tested for. Shouldn't you have tested those residues that Stephen Jones has found, according to your own dictates?
No. As I said before, the process we followed was very systematic. We looked at possible hypotheses. We decided technically what would muster to be a credible hypothesis, and then we proceeded to investigate those credible hypotheses more in detail. The hypothesis that we deemed not to be credible, we decided were hypotheses that needed way more information to be even feasible. They are not even feasible. Just because thermite or thermate exists in some dust particles does not necessarily translate into thermite being the cause of the building failure. There's no theory around it. There's just observations, isolated observations.
So there it is. In his own words, the leader of the NIST investigation himself admitting that they didn't consider this evidence and giving us the reason why they didn't, that they'd already decided beforehand that any demolition hypothesis involving thermite was not feasible. And if you go to NIST's website and look at the Q&A about their WTC Towers investigation, they admit that they did not test for explosives or incendiaries at all. Question number 22, quote, did the NIST investigation look for evidence of the WTC Towers being brought down by controlled demolition? Was the steel tested for explosives or thermite residues? And their answer? NIST did not test for the residue of these compounds in the steel. Now, we can argue, as we say here in the UK, until the cows come home, as to whether or not NIST was justified in deciding beforehand that the hypothesis of controlled demolition was not feasible. And you can go to their website, you can read their reasons for this, and you can decide for yourself if you think they're convincing or not. But whatever the reasons, the fact remains that they didn't test for explosives, and they didn't test for thermite. That is, they didn't do what the US National Fire Protection Association in its NFPA 921 guidelines recommended that they should have done. And of course, because they didn't test, they were then able confidently to say, as they do on the very same page of their website, NIST found no corroborating evidence for alternative hypotheses suggesting that the WTC towers were brought down by controlled demolition using explosives planted prior to September 11th, 2001. So they didn't find anything because there wasn't anything there? No, they didn't find anything because they didn't actually look for it. Now, that strikes me as more than a little disingenuous, I have to say. They didn't look for it, so then they can announce they didn't find it? And yet they want us to trust their judgment in the choice of hypotheses to investigate? This does not look like science to me. It looks more like politics dressed up as science. And the late Dr. Lynn Margulis wholeheartedly agreed. She was one of the world's leading biological scientists who sadly died in 2011, and although she wasn't an engineer, she was certainly someone who recognised the scientific method when she saw it, and equally recognised its absence when she didn't see it.
So what, to me, is most impressive, since I do microscopic work all the time, are the many, many microscopic samples that show these extremely, totally unique red-gray crystals, red and gray in the same crystal, and it was found in all the dust samples. So the preconceived notion of NIST is that there's no evidence for explosives, and so there's no point in looking. That is the most unscientific thing that you can possibly think of, not to look because you don't expect to find evidence. And in fact, the evidence is overwhelming that these red-gray crystals are very high temperature incendiaries. And so they have a lot of evidence for something they have no explanation for. They don't even look at it. They ignore it completely, ignorant, and dismiss the explosive argument. And on the other hand, give an argument that's patently false, that no scientist will accept, that fires, office fires, can bring buildings down at the speed roughly of gravity, of free fall. They state these conclusions, for which there's virtually no evidence, and then they ignore conclusions that can be drawn from the evidence. This is not a scientific procedure at all. So NIST hires this UL, this Underwriter Laboratories, to they do their work, and they show that the floors did not fail, they did not give way. And then NIST doesn't like that result because it doesn't fit into their computer model, so they ignore the real result, and they misrepresent some and provide evidence from authority that their computer model is right. Well, people do this every day, and they call it science. And the people who do it call themselves scientists. I claim they're not doing science at all. They're doing propaganda or publicity or whatever they're doing, but it's not science.
My last port of call in this very cursory look at 9/11, because of course there's a vast amount more that could be said about this, is the Pentagon. Perhaps here at last we shall find solid ground upon which at least this part of the official narrative can sit without too much discomfort. Well, not so, according to Dr. Kevin Barrett, who I was very fortunate to have as my first interview guest. Now, leaving aside the question as to whether or not it really was a Boeing 757 that hit the Pentagon that day, which is a matter of disagreement among researchers, let's just get a flavour of some of the problems surrounding the official story of what happened at the Pentagon.
There are all kinds of reasons to be 100% certain that the official story, according to which a man named Hani Hanjour, who was unable to fly a Cessna, he was not allowed to solo in a Cessna by flight schools, is said to have taken over this flight, Flight 77, over Ohio, and flown maybe 800 or 1,000 miles back to Washington, D.C., and flown over the Pentagon, and then turned around, and supposedly he did this amazing stunt maneuver of dropping 8,000 feet in less than 2 minutes, coming in at ground level to put a hole in only the first two floors of the Pentagon, a tiny little hole, actually, 15-foot diameter hole, without scratching the lawn. This story is utterly absurd. In fact, trained pilots have said not only could they not possibly make a 757 on that flight path, that the gravity, the G's that would be experienced would disable the pilot, but that it's physically impossible. This plane couldn't follow that flight path. There was a lot of testimony that there was a military jet or a cruise missile or something like that that may have followed that flight path and hit the Pentagon. But most of the damage in the Pentagon was clearly done by bombs, not by any airborne object, although some of it might have been partly from a cruise missile. If you actually look at the photos of the Pentagon damage and you look at the eyewitness reports, one way to know this very quickly is the eyewitnesses reported vast amounts of damage, tremendous damage, and many, many deaths. And this is officially, in the official version, in the A and B rings of the Pentagon, which is the core, the center of the Pentagon. And yet, if you look at the supposed path where the plane hit the Pentagon and supposedly, you know, sliced through it, what you find is that there's absolutely no damage to the walls of the A and B rings. In other words, nothing came through there. So the A and B rings were bombed. There's a it's a big, you know, bomb crater in the middle of the A and B rings, and no path of any alleged plane leading to it. Likewise, there are two areas of major damage out in the the E and D rings, the outer rings, and one of them is more or less in the area of the official flight path of the plane that they claim hit the Pentagon. The other is a huge bomb crater that's hundreds of feet away, not even close to being anywhere near the flight path of the plane. So Barbara Honegger, who just retired recently as the leading military affairs journalist for the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California, she's very tight with Naval Intelligence. And part of the reason I think that she and other Naval Intelligence people are not very happy about this is that Naval Intelligence was targeted. They killed a bunch of people in a surgical bombing in the Pentagon under the cover of this so-called plane strike. The Naval Intelligence has been a thorn in the side of the Bush crime family, which is CIA-based, for decades. And the other thing they targeted with the surgical bombings in the Pentagon was the accountants. The accounting office was wiped out. And very interestingly, the day before 9/11, on September 10th, 2001, Donald Rumsfeld had gone on television on C-SPAN and announced that $2.3 trillion was missing from the Pentagon. That's about, it's over five times the Pentagon's annual budget
that
at the time
huge.
Had gone missing. Mm. Yeah, five times the annual budget was gone. He announced that on Monday the 10th. Nobody ever announces self-damaging bad news on a Monday, because then the media has all week to give it legs. So whenever there's a self-damaging revelation, it always comes out on Friday. But first time in history, and the last, Rumsfeld announces this horrific bad news. Five times the annual budget of the Pentagon has just disappeared. He announces that on Monday, September 10th. And on Tuesday, the 11th, boom, along comes this news story, shall we say, that just wipes off the missing money story from out of history. And today, hardly anyone even remembers this except for 9/11 truthers. So it's quite a coincidence, isn't it, that the accounting office in the Pentagon that was supposedly hot on the trail of the missing $2.3 trillion was targeted by a surgical bombing strike under cover of a non-existent hijacked plane impact.
And I also understand that it wouldn't have been a very good target anyway, because the top brass would have been the other side of the Pentagon.
Well, that's right. A true terrorist could have inflicted immense damage on the Pentagon and killed most of the top brass pretty easily. And the way to do that would be you would just dive your plane into the roof of the Pentagon, this huge, I forget how many acre roof. It's a gigantic roof, really easy target, and do that over on the opposite wing of the Pentagon, the east wing. The wing where the brass is. But instead, we're told that Hani Hanger, who couldn't fly a Cessna, performed an amazing stunt maneuver precisely in order to strike the Pentagon as far as possible away from the top brass, where the building had been newly reinforced, where damage would be minimal. And he did this. You know, it required incredible flying that's completely impossible. Whereas anybody who could fly a 757 or any other kind of plane could easily hit that roof and cause so much more damage. So the official story doesn't make sense in a long list of ways. And then, of course, we have the issue of the video of the Pentagon event. Just minutes after the Pentagon event, the FBI showed up and confiscated video from a hotel across the street and from a gas station.
Do we have, is it three or four frames do we have? Is that right?
Yeah, they, after a long fight, many, many years later, I think it was like as late as 2007 or so, they finally released a few frames from these videos, and they don't show any plane. We actually have the hotel video now too. And in both cases, these videos, plus one, a few frames from a Pentagon security camera that have been released, none of these videos show any plane. In fact, one of them shows a vapor trail and, maybe a little bit of an object heading towards the Pentagon. But whatever it is, it's a lot smaller than a 757 would be. It's leaving a vapor trail, which only rockets do at sea level, not passenger planes. So the government's evidence, which it withheld for so many years, does not support any kind of hijacked plane impact, quite the opposite.
So there you have it. a comprehensive list of reasons why we shouldn't just accept the official account of 9/11. Well, obviously not. As I said before, this is a vast subject, and there is a huge number of problems with the official story that I could have talked about. And if you do want to find out more, I recommend in particular the books of Dr. David Ray Griffin. But of course, there's only so much that I can include in a single podcast, and I may well return to the subject at a later date to look at some of the other issues. But I think that what I've shared already is enough in itself to accomplish what this podcast set out to do. Namely, very simply to prompt the asking of questions. So if all this achieves is that a handful of people start asking questions of their own, then I will consider this podcast to have succeeded. But by now, you must be wondering why I called this podcast 9/11 and People of Faith, because so far I haven't said anything that seems remotely related to matters of religion. And I did that deliberately because I didn't want it to seem as if the only people I intended to talk to were those who believe in God. But at this juncture, I do want to bring up the matter of faith. And the reason is this. The 10th anniversary of 9/11 happened to fall on a Sunday. It also happened to be a day when I wasn't preaching, so I went to our local church, and I was amazed that there was virtually no mention of what had happened 10 years before. There was one prayer for the relatives and friends of those who died that day, but that was it. So I thought that maybe after the service, when most of the congregation goes through into the adjoining hall for tea and coffee and spends an hour or so chatting, that somebody would make some mention of it. But so far as I could tell, there was nothing, and I was listening very carefully. And I have to say that this really disturbed me. I mean, for us living over here in the UK, for the vast majority of us, it didn't affect us directly. But indirectly, it affects us all. As I said at the beginning of the podcast, 9/11 precipitated the so-called War on Terror and the domestic surveillance paradigm, which is certainly alive and kicking over here in the UK. And so again, we have to be as certain as we possibly can be that what we've been told about that day is in fact true. But how can we be sure that it is true if we don't ask any questions? Now, I think that every sane person believes that truth is important. I know there are some people who claim not to believe in truth, but nobody really lives their life that way. If you didn't think that some things are true and other things are false, you're not going to live very long. Everyone, at least practically, believes in truth. And I would say most people are actually quite passionate about the truth, and even believe that it's worth sacrificing parts of our lives to lay hold of it. But people of faith, and I don't just mean Christians, but also people of other faith traditions and none, who believe in the God who is there, well, we openly profess to believe in the truth. That is, our belief in truth may not be any more passionately held than other people's, but we've made a further publicly open step of professing our commitment to truth. And speaking as a Christian to other Christians, let me point to what Jesus says on the matter in John's Gospel. He says, "I am the way and the truth and the life." He also says, "You will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." And of course, I'm not unaware that the word truth there is being used in a theologically special way. Yes, of course it is. But it cannot mean anything less than what we generally understand by the word truth. Christians are openly committed to truth. And sometimes that commitment is costly. As Jesus said, "You must take up your cross and follow me." So what should the Christian's response be to the things that I've been discussing in this podcast? Should it be, well, I mustn't think about those things because somebody might disapprove of me. I'm not going to think about 9/11 because somebody might call me a conspiracy theorist. Anyway, it's not for me to question because somebody in authority has already told me what to think. All of those reactions, I suggest, are based on fear. And as I've said throughout the podcast, all I'm advocating is that we ask questions. I don't know what happened that day. I have my own views about it, of course, but I don't know in the sense that I can prove it. But what I do know is that there are severe problems with what's been presented to us as the truth. So as people who are committed to the truth, whether we're believers or not, we must ask our questions and not bury our heads in the sand. And if the official story comes up smelling of roses, fine, end of story. But if it doesn't, and it costs us, well, I would say so be it. At least then we shall have been faithful to ourselves and to the truth, and if we believe, to his command to love the truth. So thank you for spending this time with me. Whenever and wherever you happen to be, you have been listening to The Mind Renewed with me, Julian Charles, and I very much look forward to speaking to you again in the near future.